Harry, it's great to have you on the show for the first time. And talk about this new Three Tremors album that you are a part of that's coming out this month.
Yeah, well, about probably 7 years ago, I was at a Keep It True festival in Germany with Jag Panzer. And Jag Panzer was headlining, and Sean Peck was actually singing with a band called Warrior. And so he was doing a stand-in type thing. And so we looked up them. That's the first time I ever met him, first time I ever heard of his band Cage and everything, because I don't, I usually am close-minded about my metal. You know, I only like certain bands. I don't really go out and search much for other bands, you know, basically because I don't want to accidentally be influenced by other people and have it change my writing style. So anyway, we met up afterwards in Munich. I think it was in Munich. It might have been in Frankfurt or something like that on the way back to the States. We were in the holding area. So we got to talking, and he said, "Hey, man, I'm thinking of, you know, doing this project that's been in the works now for a while, and would you be interested?" So I gave him all my contact information and told him, "Yeah, sure. You know, sounds like a blast." So about maybe a year from that point, he got a hold of me and said, "Hey, man, you know, it looks like it's coming through. I got Ripper Owens on board. I was thinking about getting Ralph Schiefers, but he's a little too busy with his new album coming out right now. And so I wonder if you're still interested." I said, "Yeah, send me some tracks, and we'll do what we can." So he and his band Cage had basically written all the material already in order to get the project off the ground. And so he just sent me some vocal guide tracks and, you know, occasionally harmonies here and there, that said, "Hey, you know, re-record all this stuff," and he gave it to me also with no vocals, and sent it back to me. And so I recorded my vocals on it, scratched for a while. We made embellishments. We made, you know, some, "Hey, can you do this instead of that?" Or "Can you do more of this?" Or "Can you do less of that?" Or whatever. And after we went through it a couple of times, we came up with something that was kind of viable. So by that time, Tim was doing his deal projects and everything, and he had laid some tracks down also. So once they got time to mix the album, they kind of mixed all of us and the songs together and came out with, like, you know, the strongest parts in this and strongest parts in that. And that's how the album came together. So then once the album was together, we figured we'd come up with a release date and then start the tour. Well, what happened was is we got a tour started in Europe just for about, I don't know, 18 days, I think is what it was. And it started out in Tel Aviv, which was really cool. But the album got put back on the back burner as far as release. So then that tour, which was supposed to be basically a press release tour, turned out to be kind of like just a feeler to see how the crowd was going to respond to music that they'd never heard before, you know. So it was great. We got some of the nights were sold out, and the crowd response was killer every night. And we played every song on the record, all 12 songs were reviewed in our set. So that made us feel good that, you know, there wasn't one song that was weak, and, you know, all the songs, you know, were great. And the way we paced the show was really cool. So then we came back to the States, and now we're waiting for, you know, the release, which is now it's out, and we're going to do some, you know, U.S. dates and on the East Coast and maybe the Midwest to see how well it shapes out, since people can actually get the product now. So
Harry, what was your first impression of Sean when you first heard him sing, first saw him perform, and when you first met him? What was, like, you know, one of the first things that came to mind when you first came in contact with him and knew who he was?
Yeah, I thought he had a really great voice, and his range was crazy, and he has this, like, Mariah Carey thing that he does with his voice, almost like a whistle, to where he can shoot, like, way up into the, you know, mezzo-soprano and even, you know, the higher soprano with his voice. And I've always tried to do that, and I could never get my voice to do that. But he could do that. That was really cool. And he uses that quite a bit. And when I saw him with Warrior, I thought, you know, his stage presence was great. And, you know, I was like, who is this guy? This guy sounds great. So when I met him at the airport, you know, I was like, dude, you are killing it, you know. And that's when he said, oh, well, shit, I've been doing this as long as you. And, you know, believe it or not, you know, you're like one of the main reasons that I wanted to do this. And I'm like, what? So, you know, we had that kind of, you know, camaraderie and stuff. And, you know, there's nobody there's no egos in this band. We're all just like, you know, excellent musicians that get along real well together. And we were on close quarters in the tour for, you know, 8-9 hours at a time in one little bus, sitting right next to each other, kind of crammed together, and never had any complaints, never had any, you know, problems. So it was really great the way that we get along. Uh-huh. And the brotherhood that we have within the band unit. So, but yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I loved Jugulator when it first came out. That was the first time I ever heard Tim, was when he did Jugulator. And I happened to be in Germany. And a friend of mine named Gutz Kuhneman, who now works for a different magazine called Death Forever, we were in the back of his BMW, and he had it cranked as high as it could go, listening to the press release of that album. So he got it, like, Gutz got it, like, 10 days before anybody else did. And I was just like, oh, my God, this guy's incredible. Thanks, man. This guy's incredible. You know, he's perfect fit for Judas Priest now. And, you know, he gave it, like, a heavier edge and everything. So to hear that Tim was actually on this project and that our voices are similar but are different enough for people to be able to pick our voice out of the songs makes the product, you know, makes the band and the song sound even better, because we have our own separate personality that no one seems close enough to another voice. Mm-hmm. that you know, takes away from our individuality. So
right. So
yeah, we're all great guys, and we're all on the same pretty much plateau of singing, you know, and we all have great respect for each other. So I think it's going to be a long lasting relationship.
You know, when I asked and Ripper and Sean about you, I asked them, you know, what's Harry Conklin like to be with? What's he like to hang around? What's he like being in this? What's it like being in a band with him? And they basically said that you were a very intense guy. You're singing constantly, that you're like the life of the party. I mean, that's really the gist of what they said. And, you know, they've always had, you know, these guys really have a tremendous amount of love and respect.
Yeah,
for you.
I was like the class clown. I was always cracking jokes and, you know, singing funny things. And, you know, it was crazy. So everybody, I was like the light in the darkness, you know? Uh-huh. So, yeah, that's kind of what helped us all get along was, you know, our you know, the happy times. So, but yeah, it's great. I mean, Tim has some real funny quirks and stuff, too. You know, once he comes out of his shell, and he's got funny things to say about the times when he was on tour, because he's got a vast history of all the times when, you know, he's done crazy stuff. So, yeah, it was great. You know, it's great to be around those guys. I feel really blessed to be, you know, part of this band. It's going to be awesome.
Now, in my opinion,
I can't wait to go on tour again the next few days. So,
well, you know, my opinion, you guys have such a great musical chemistry together, and that's not something that can just happen. I mean, that's something that really, it takes a lot for that to happen. And my question for you really quickly, Harry, is this, is, you know, how long did it take you to realize you guys had that musical chemistry together to be in this band?
Not until we, you know, got on stage with each other, because we basically were just in our own homes, wherever that was. you know,
right,
and recording tracks all the way up until the first day of the tour. So we had, you know, got together like 2 days before the tour started and had a rehearsal in the rehearsal studios that Cage rehearses at in San Diego. And that's it. You know, other than those 2 days, that was it. And it was still a little stressed just because, you know, this is the first time that all three of us have been on stage together, and we were trying to figure out when our parts come in and go out. So we had it mapped out vocally as far as who sings what when, but we had to make changes live just because, okay, well, Harry sounds a little bit better on this part. Let's give Tim the whole verse instead of just a part of the verse because what he's saying is very prolific there. And things like that. So, you know, let's have Sean sing the whole chorus, you know, or let's. And so we made some adjustments, and then once we made those adjustments, then we had to even further hone the show. So it took about probably 3 or 4 shows into the tour before we were really solid on, you know, the type of show that we were going to present to the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was really trippy. Like the moment we got together, in the rehearsals, nothing was stressed. We all do our own. We have our own separate songs, you know, like the Gripper does Bloodstained from Judas Priest Jugulator. Sean does Hell Destroyer, which is his nickname song, and I do Black from Fourth Judgment. So during those songs, the guys had a chance to, like, you know, go out in the audience type thing and check it out, and we all really enjoyed, you know, everybody's performance and mm-hmm. and give each other, you know, the spotlight on the stage, and it's great. The camaraderie is just freaking perfect. So,
well,
it's a really enjoyable, high energy show, you know.
As a singer myself, Harry, to be able to go on stage and have parts mapped out and remember where to sing and how on all these songs, you know, to me, it sounds like a pretty daunting task. And was it difficult to do this when you guys first started playing together?
Yeah, well, we both, Ripper and I, well, Sean had already been rehearsing with Cage like for 6 weeks prior, you know, because he's right there. And they had this rehearsal space, so he would come in, and Sean would just sing the whole thing, everybody's part, you know, and instead of just singing his part, so that he could get through the song with the vocal cues and everything. So when it came time to separate, both Tim and I had it mapped out on cheat sheets that you know, when our parts came in and when our harmonies were, according to the way that we had mapped it out on the record. So that's sometimes that we have to say, okay, well, let's stop. Let's not do this the way it's mapped out. Let's do it this way. And then so we'd make our little notes. So when it came time to, you know, doing it live, we redid our vocal cheat sheets to the notes, to the new notes that we worked out during the rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to work out really great because then people were getting a little bit more parts instead of, you know, coming in just one or two lines of the verse or one or two lines. People were getting whole verses now. People were getting whole choruses now.
Mm-hmm.
People were getting, you know, maybe Harry's scream at the time was kind of a moderately high, but now Harry's doing the super high scream. So let's Harry do the super high scream on that and give Sean a break, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So if somebody got sick or they just weren't feeling it that night, they'd say, hey man, you know, can you cover me on this spot? Can you cover me on that spot? And so we kind of, you know, covered each other vocally, and also it gave us a real release instead of singing all the songs all the time and talking in between. We only interject our part every now and then. Sometimes on a couple of songs, I just might be embellishments or backups, or maybe sing like a half of a verse, and that's it. Everybody else is covering the other rest of the parts. And the same thing with them. There may be a part where Sean almost completely relaxes that whole song and only comes in on a couple of parts because Tim and I, you know, are covering all the rest of the parts.
Right.
So there's a time for each one of us to relax and take a break and just give it our all when our part comes in. And so that's what makes the live performance shine that much even more, because we're not taxing ourselves completely all the time. There's little spots where we can take breaks and then come in and just bam, you know.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to shift gears a little bit over to Jagpanzer, because I really love the last album you guys put out with. I mean, that record was just absolutely phenomenal and probably the best album that you've ever put out. And, you know, talk about that last album and talk about, you know, in my opinion, why that album was as strong as it was.
Yeah, it's definitely the most diverse record that we've come out with. It has, like, ballads. It's got moderate tempo songs. It's got high tempo songs. It's got songs that sound like they just came off, like Blacklist, that just came off of Ample Destruction. So it covers like almost the whole genre of Jagpanzer in that one album. Huh. And we have songs that could be crossover songs, like Long Awaited Kiss. That almost has like a swing country feel, so that could even turn out to be like a crossover song and be played on other, you know, genres of radio if it ever gets the chance. So to us, we just put everything into it, and which is something that we always do with every album. We always attack it and put as much of ourselves into it as possible. But this last album was just like the most diverse that we've ever done. The songs, there's a couple of riffs. Everybody donated on this album. When John played his bass, he would donate some riffs. The drummer would come in and say, you know what, the program that you have for this is great, but check out what I got, you know. And sometimes it would completely change the feel of the song. There's one song that we did to where we got all the way up to the cutting room floor, and I told Mark, you know what, Mark? I don't know if you're holding back too, but there's something about this chorus and the bridge section that is just not grabbing me. And he's like, you know what? I know it too, and I was afraid to tell you because I didn't want to step on your shoes. And I'm like, dude, you know, if you feel of anything that needs to be changed all the way up until the album gets mixed or mastered, we can make changes, you know, because nobody's heard this before. So we rewrote the whole entire chorus and the whole entire bridge of that song. And it took me like a day, day and a half to rewrite it, because I already was, you know, tooling around with the idea. And it changed the title. It changed the whole feel of the song. Mark had to go in, change some guitar parts and stuff, but man, it made that song like 20 times better. And so we were just like, man, you know, this. If ever we have any ideas, let's not be afraid to come forth and do it. Let's just, you know, be bold and say, look, man, you know, this kind of ain't fitting it. This ain't, I'm not feeling it, you know? Do you have something else for me? Mm-hmm. You know? Can you come up with something else? And then, you know, I think every song stands alone on this record. You know, you could take one song off this record and it would be intense. But you can put, it's one album that I can put on and I can play and I can listen to all the way through, and I can let it restart again, you know.
Right.
For me, and it's weird because I hate hearing myself sing. It's really weird. I don't know. There's a lot of singers that are like that. That just, you know, once they get done with their project, they don't want to touch it anymore because they can't stand, even though they put as much production into it and as much thought and energy that they can to make every vocal note perfect, there's still a certain nuance, you know, that's like, you know, I could have done this better, you know, or I'm doing it better now 5 or 10 years later. So this was the first album, along with Scourge, that I could actually sit down and I could just put it on and listen to it all the way through without having to skip a song.
Right.
And then when it comes to restart, I can hear it again. So it was we know that if we can please ourselves, then we can please our friends, our fans and our friends. So.
Right.
Well, you know, and two, my favorite Jagpanzer albums are the last three. I love The Scourge of Light. I love Casting the Stones, even though I think that album ended up getting a bad rap. But, you know, and this new album, you guys have really put out three pretty amazing albums the last three times out.
Yeah, that was a great, you know, Take to the Skies off that album. And there's a lot of great songs and stuff that is on Casting the Stones. It kind of got pushed to the side, but, you know, there's a new generation that's pulling this stuff out and that are re-listening to those albums and those songs and going, oh my God, these songs are, some of them are 30 years old and they stand the test of time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I talked to Mark about and I really loved that came out were the High Roller reissues of the early Jagpanzer albums, specifically, you know, the EP and Ample Destruction. And I you know, Ample Destruction, was a classic record in a lot of people's minds. And talk about those reissues and how they did for you. And, you know, maybe give us some memories and you know, talk a bit about that first Jagpanzer album that came out so long ago now.
Well, we had to do those reissues just because there was so much tape trading in Europe, especially, and on the East Coast, that people were getting inferior products. And people were spending a lot of money. You know, we were hearing about this, spending 30, 40, maybe 80 euros on getting an inferior copy product, you know. Especially when we, you know, Jagpanzer always took the time to sign everybody's everything. You know, I don't care if they got 30 products. We're going to sign each and every one of them. We're going to take the time to get to know you. And I don't care, you know, if our line is 200 people long, we're going to take that time to see everybody and sign everything. So we see everything that comes by, and we're like, what? We didn't authorize this issue. These, you know, they're, Take This Pain was never on Animal Destruction. So we were kind of pissed us off that people were getting ripped off by, you know, these tape traders and stuff. So we actually reissued them with additional B-side songs, or we throw Inagata DeVita on it, or we throw something that was previously unreleased on there, and we maybe remix it, remaster it to bring it up to, you know, the snuff of the rest of the songs. But now people were getting an actual authorized, good quality product from Jagpanzer on these re-releases. Mm-hmm. And that way, we could ensure that people were paying a good price and that they were not getting ripped off and they were getting a superior product. And plus, it helped alleviate from all these people trading around, because now they could get a superior product directly from the band that had bonus tracks on it that were normally something that, you know, were fifth generation of tape that were, you know, just crap by the time they got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why we get those re-releases, just to make sure that, you know, people are getting an official high quality product and, you know, not get ripped off. We don't want anybody to get ripped off in the name of Jagpanzer, you know, that's not our deal. So,
well, you know, when The Fourth Judgment and Age of Mastery came out, you know, metal was starting to make its comeback. It was starting to come out of the dungeon. And did you expect it to do as well as it did, you know, after you made those couple of records, which obviously, you know, really helps, you know, really propelled the scene up, you know, out of the doldrums, in a sense, to, you know, now being something that has gotten a lot bigger?
Well, actually, we were really looking forward to having the original lineup in The Fourth Judgment on the tour, but something happened with Joey that he had made another commitment, and so he had to back out of that tour like within 2 weeks, almost like 3 weeks prior to us engaging on our first tour with Century Media. And so that kind of blew the resurgence for Jagpanzer out of the water, because everybody was expecting to see, you know, the original lineup, you know, aside from Rick Hilliard, who was not even drumming at the time. But Rickard Sternquist had been in the band for like 8 years, 10 years prior, so he was a solid member. But so it kind of like really bummed out Century Media, and it bummed out us too to have Joey, you know, bump off the tour so early. So then we got this guy Chris, who was in college for guitar, and so he was referred to us by another guy that we actually wanted to get in the band for the tour. And this guy said, "Nah, man, you don't want me. I'm great, but you want this guy." So we got Chris in the band, and in a couple of weeks, he was learning everything note for note. And if he didn't have it quite, you know, on the tour, he was rehearsing every day and going over everything every day, right off the record. And he would rehearse for 2, 3, 4 hours at a time, you know, on the tour bus or whatever, just to get these songs just perfect. Mm-hmm. And so he was very well received by the fans. And so we were like, okay, well, this is great. Let Joey do his thing. And, you know, if he wants to come back someday, great. Well, we got Chris in the band for like 7 years. And Chris would probably still be in the band to this day had it not come up for the auditions for Megadeth. So Chris's girlfriend at the time, Stephanie Cabral, she's got really deep ties with the Megadeth guys, the Megadeth crew, and, you know, because she still is a really high quality photographer for bands. And so she heard first off that they were doing auditions, and so she told Chris, "Dude, this would be a perfect thing for you," because Chris, you know, was kind of into Megadeth too a little bit. And so he was like, "Oh, great." So Stephen, you know, helped him out to make sure that he was there for the auditions. And bam, he got the gig. So he was kind of like, "Should I do this?" And everybody at Jack Benson was like, "Are you crazy, Chris? You know, you totally need to do this. And don't worry about us. We'll fine." So we fell back to another Chris who was in the band a long time ago when we joined. And his name was Chris LeSeg. And he had basically did the basement tapes of Jag Panzer, Chain of Command. And he wrote a lot of the songs, She Waits. He wrote a lot of songs on Dissident Alliance. And so he was a great guitarist. He was very accomplished. He had basically got out of the band because Chris LeSeg, a long time ago, got into the military. And so there was like basically a no Jag Panzer for a few years, just because they, you know, they did the Dissident Alliance thing with other guitarists, and it was a little bit heavier, which I really enjoyed because, you know, it was the super heavy side of Jag Panzer. Mm-hmm. So we fell back to Chris, and Chris came up with some ideas to write some songs, and that's how we came out with Scourge. And everybody was like, "Well, who's this guy?" But to me, Chris LeSeg was the perfect combination of the technicality of Chris Brodrick and the loose fluidity and the legato feel of Joey Tafoya. Mm-hmm. So he kind of bridged the gap between those two. But what happened with Chris was he found out he had, like, stage fright. Our first gig with Chris LeSeg was at Bang Your Head, and it wasn't Bang Your Head. It was another festival gig that we did on the side of the Thames, I think. Anyway, it was a big festival gig, and we got up on stage. And usually those gigs are really loose because since they're huge festivals, the sound is perfect and the lighting is perfect and the audience responds to just about everything you do because there's like 30,000 people there. But he still got a sense of stage fright. And he didn't know this or wasn't aware of it because he's always been behind the scenes and he never really toured with Jag Panzer, you know. They always just played a couple of nightclub gigs locally, you know. Mm. So then he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to have to bow out because this is not my scene. I'm not going to be able to do these tours. This is freaking me out too much." So we're like, "Okay, Chris, you know, that's cool." So it came to figure out that Joey Tafoya was not busy. And so we gave him a call and said, "Hey, Joey, what are you doing, man? Would you mind coming on board and doing another record or two?" And he's like, "Sure, we'll do it." But in the same Joey fashion, he's doing the record and everything, and as soon as the record comes out, oops, I'm doing this other thing. So we're stuck, you know. So he got in Graham Bonnet and was doing an album with Graham Bonnet and touring around with Graham Bonnet, and we're like, crap, you know. What do we do now? You know, so. Well. So we got another guitarist that to fill out some shows recently, and this guy has been doing the same thing that Chris has been doing. He's been on his off time just trying to learn everything note for note, and he's got really great chemistry with everybody in the band, and for some reason, he's the only player so far, the lead player, that has really synced with Mark rhythm-wise. Mark has kind of like a laid-back feel when it comes to rhythm. He's almost on the downside of the beat. You know, he likes to drag things out a little bit. And so sometimes these lead players that would play on the beat would give it like a jumpy feel. But this new lead player here synced up with Mark and kind of laid back the same way as Mark did. And so now it gives it this big, huge, almost like a Black Sabbath-y feel, because the rhythms are dragging back a little bit and you know, giving it this open style of playing. And Mark really loves that. You know, he syncs really well with Mark. And so there's a great chemistry between Mark and the lead guitarist again that we haven't had since Chris Broderick. So, So I think this guy's going to work out really good.
Now, another interesting album you did with Jagpanzer was called Tane to the Throne. And, you know, I thought it was very heavily misunderstood. I thought it was really misunderstood when it came out, but I thought it was a great record. You know, you have a Shakespeare epic with the power metal album. And let's talk about the making of that album, maybe some memories you have and thoughts you have looking back at that record.
Yeah, well, we were on tour with Iced Earth, and sometimes we would get our own little like nine-passenger van to haul our backline and stuff in, and not be on their bus. So this was the track to where we had this nine-passenger van, and there was like hours and hours of us driving, and we had a designated driver. So Rickard came up with the idea. He's like, "Dude, I think it's about time that we came up with a concept album." And we all looked at each other and said, "Okay, let's do this." Well, he says, I've always wanted to do this around the play Macbeth, because it has, according to Rickard, it has every element of heavy metal in it. It's got deceit, it's got murder, it's got treachery, it has, you know, it's got these evil witches in it, it's got magic, it's got swords, you know, and so they said, you know, "Harry, if you can, you know, read about this and like put it in layman's terms, we'll write the music." And so we'll kind of read the play ourselves and come up with some songs. So they came up with like 13 songs. I think at one point there was like 15 different musical pieces. And so it was my job to take those musical pieces and arrange them in a certain way to where there was a certain emotion that matched the magic, the musical piece that went along with the play. And then so use maybe some phrases actually out of the play in between songs or maybe within the play, and then also bring it to layman's terms to where people can understand it, because that speech is like really difficult, you know. It has its own rhythm. It's not the greatest, you know, words to write to. So we cut out a few songs that didn't quite make the cut, you know, that they were too aggressive in this spot or they weren't aggressive enough. And after I had gone through about maybe five or six different arrangements, we finally agreed to the final arrangement. Well, then we needed embellishments, and we needed segues from song to song. So Chris Broderick needed to invent a guitar piece, a string guitar piece, like a quartet along with violins, as a project for his graduation in his guitar performance from college. So he took a couple of pieces and he did added them in Fame, and then that way it was also a released piece that would give him extra credit because it was actually released. So he got together with the string quartet and came up with, you know, actually wrote that piece on the spot as the quartet was in the studio, and gave the piece to it, and they kind of worked it out. And then also he devised that acoustic string piece that was kind of like almost like a Spanish guitar type of piece. And he wrote that basically as a part for his college, but also, you know, it made it to the album. So now we had segues in between, but then we also had parts like that couldn't, there was parts that were missing. So Mark had this epic piece that we wanted to make it at the end of the song, but it was so epic that there wasn't any one part of the play that we could add to it. So what I did was I took all the parts of the play that wasn't discussed in the previous songs and put it in that one epic piece at the end. So so it kind of ties everything all together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, then we came out with it, and we intended on making it almost like a mind crime, to where it was kind of like an acted out play with just a couple of other actors. And we had a German girl in mind that was a real good singer. And we had a couple other guys, but Century Media could never, you know, give us the budget to support that. And that means just, you know, having those extra characters on tour with us and paying for their rooms, paying for their meals, paying for their flights. It never could quite make it. So that's the reason why Fame just, we had to pull out songs from Fame and never able to do Fame as one complete epic piece.
Right.
Because we were never able to get enough people to support it, you know.
So this album's been out for a while, and, you know, the one thing I have to ask you is that, you know, now that we've had some time for people to check this thing out, you know, what's the response been so far to this record, and, you know, has it been positive, good, and maybe talk about the response so far?
Our pre-sales have been, like, through the roof. We got like 8,000 pre-sales, which is excellent for an album that's first of its kind, you know. We have patches, we've got packs, and so it helps, you know, people get involved with the band. But as far as like our live performance, you see a lot of YouTube footage, and there's some shows in Greece that are just like spot on, incredible shows. And the sound is really great, and people are really latching on to that, and they're really looking forward to these live shows. They're seeing the energy from the crowd, they're hearing the energy from the songs, they're seeing the energy from the players on stage, they're seeing the network that happens on stage, the chemistry between all of us players on stage,
mm-hmm.
how everybody, you know, is high-fiving each other, and how we're doing like stage moves and stuff with each other on stage. And so we all equally share the spotlight, even when it comes to the lead guitarists. You know, we're not keeping the musicians in the back with the three vocalists up front in the spotlight the whole time. We're a complete band. I mean, we're moving in and out, we're interacting with each other. It's a great thing to see.
So Harry, for my last question, do you have any last words for the fans that are going to be checking out this interview?
Yeah, don't miss it, man, whatever the cost. If you have to drive 200 miles out of your way to go see it, it's going to be worth it. Because, you know, who knows how long this is going to happen. We'd like to come up with a second album, but with everybody's schedules, you know, as they're growing, it may come to a point to where we just can't get together long enough to tour this. So this may be in a once-in-a-lifetime thing. If you happen to miss it, you'll miss out big time. But it's a great spectacle, and we bring our A game. Everybody's bringing our A game to the show. So make sure that whatever the cost and however far you're going to drive, that you make it to the show.